Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Annie.
And I'm Ray. Today we are discussing the upcoming Africana Film Festival in Albany with Professor Kevin Hickey.
Then we'll hear about bio art from Portuguese visitors to the Capital Region. Afterwards, we'll speak to editor David King of the Alt Weekly magazine.
And later on, we'll hear about physics from David Borton. Let's start the show with some rapid-fire local headlines.
The Times Union today called for the state's criminal justice system to re-examine the sentences for prisoners who were sentenced for crimes they committed when they were 16 or 17 years old. The state legislature joined the rest of the nation last year in raising the age at which one is tried as a criminal to 18 years old. The change reflected an understanding that teenage brains are not fully developed and a recognition that minority youths are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. However, there are still individuals in prison who were sentenced under the prior rules.
The Times Union reported that the city of Mechanicville will hire an outside lawyer to conduct an investigation into allegations that Mayor Dennis Baker engages in regular intimidation, harassment, demeaning, and threatening behavior against the city's police force. The complaint included claims of name-calling, barging in on, and contaminating crime scenes, demanding issuance of more tickets, and threatening to shut down the entire department.
New York State's tax structure could be entirely rewritten in the upcoming weeks as Governor Andrew Cuomo pushes for a potential payroll tax to replace the personal income tax in order to deal with the changes in the federal tax code that limit the deductibility of state and local taxes. State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli is raising concerns about the speed with which such changes may occur. Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan said it is unlikely a deal could be reached in the near future.
Governor Cuomo is expected to shortly set April 24 as the date for special elections to fill 11 vacancies in the state Senate and Assembly. This includes the Assembly seat vacated by Stephen McLaughlin when he was elected elected as Rensselaer County Executive.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Next.
The next is, tonight we begin the show with Marta DeMenezes. Ah, didn't say that right. She'll help us later. Delila Honorato. Delila is from Portugal and is assistant professor in the Department of Audio and Visual Arts at Ionia University in Corfu, Greece. Marta, also from Portugal, is an internationally known bio artist and director of two artist residency programs, Ectopia in Lisbon and Cultivamos Cultura in San Luís. Southern Portugal. Delila and Marta, thank you for being here. Help thank us you. With your names.
Thanks. Marta de Menezes. It's not easy.
Well, it's something we need to learn. Welcome. What brings you both to Troy?
Well, Kathy, hi. I think it's a common reason to come for both of us to come to Troy. We are a North American tour, and we are doing different kinds of things all over this coast and some of Canada. And Troy was just an interesting place to come and visit, no?
We had to stop.
We had to stop here.
Yeah.
Troy is fortunate that it's on the way to many places. As a cross-disciplinary scholar and as an artist, you often explore science, technology, and biology. How'd you both become interested in this type of research-based art?
Okay, let me start. The fact is that we know each other since 2016, and that is not a very long time. But we do have a parallel story with, common experiences, I would say. We had a traditional education.
Yep.
and we just felt the need for something different. So let me tell you about myself, and then Marta will, let her know her story. I teach in a department of audiovisual arts, so my students are very related and very connected into digital things. And I thought it would be a good input just to try something different. I do have some interest on biology and everything that could be a little bit more fleshy and less, you know, disconnected from our body. So that is my contribution, and the fact that in 2014 I started including other things in my teaching and providing the opportunity to my students to relate to artists and scholars working in this field.
My case is more personal, maybe. So I started working with biology as an artist when I was still at university, finishing my arts degree. So I have a very classical painting degree from a faculty of fine arts in Lisbon, and I felt very frustrated that all of the things that I was learning were very classical in their approach to reality and contemporary culture. So fortunately, I was starting to date a biologist at the time. He's now my husband. And this happened 20 years ago. So he opened up this whole world of biology to me, and I got really, really interested not only in the aesthetic aspects of life and biological sciences, but also their content, and all of my work now revolves around that.
Because we're a radio program, it's a little hard to see art and performance. Can you give us a little description of what bio art turns out to be?
BioArt is a very large umbrella, so a lot of things fall into the realm of BioArt. What I do as an artist in BioArt is I manipulate living material. So whether it's a plant, a butterfly, probably the work that I'm most famous for was actually my first work, where I manipulated the wing patterns of live butterflies while they were still in the pupa stage of their development, and then got out of the pupa with asymmetrical patterns which wouldn't occur in nature. So it can be cells, it can be plants, it can be organisms, it can be imaging, lots of different technologies and techniques, and also lots of different mediums can be used in art and biology and bioart.
I have to ask you to go back and tell us something about how do you change the pattern of a butterfly's wing?
Actually, it's a very old technology. It was created in the 60s by a scientist working on evolutionary biology, and they are studying the wing pattern and the evolutionary significance of the wing pattern in butterflies. And typically by accident, they found that by going through the pupa at a very specific time of the development of the wing of the butterfly inside the cocoon, it actually you interfere with the chemical spreading that is important for the formation of the pattern. And when you interfere with that, it actually changes the pattern. So it's very mechanical. It's not genetical, and it's really very, very easy to do. But it's a tool that they've had for a very long time.
That's astonishing. I'm really delighted to hear about that. Dalila and Marta, you've both been involved in creating conferences related to this interdisciplinary field. Can you talk about what you've done or what might be happening soon?
Sure. There
are two things that we need to talk about now.
There's right? Before meeting and after meeting each
okay.
other. So I started organizing conferences in art and science because it was a personal need of bringing people together and next to the place where I was developing my work, plus providing to my students the opportunity of having this chance. Because I don't know if you have heard, but Greece is not a country that usually develops this sort of work. Plus, we have this major economic crisis. So that was this sort of challenge that one should have the opportunity of, well, having the best possible in, well, in the time that it was mostly required. So I organize a conference called Taboo, Transgression, Transcendence in Art and Science, which is a TTT. It already happened 2 times in Corfu in Greece. And this year, 2018, it will happen in Mexico City in November, 11th till the 13th. And this is co-organized with Marta and a wonderful philosopher in Mexico City at University UNAM called Maria Antonia.
And González Valerio.
Yes, entire name. And, well, besides that, I'm also organizing the second summer school in Hybrid Arts in Corfu in June. So that could be also a good, well, a good time to visit Corfu.
Yeah. Also together, so I have Cultivamos Cultura and Ectopia in Portugal, and Cultivamos Cultura with me is co-organizing TTT with Dalila and Maria Antonia, but also with Dalila, we join forces and we're organizing this meeting in Portugal in June. Which is a meeting, a conference for women in art, science, and technology. There actually is going to be an open call very, very soon, so next week or the week after that, for both of these conferences, for TTT in Mexico and for FEM meeting in June in Portugal. And we encourage everybody to apply with a small abstract, and you can actually present and participate in both conferences.
So I myself am not an academic person, so how many people come to a conference? When you say the call will go out, does that mean all over the world?
Yeah, yes, of course, they're international conferences, both of them. Depends on the conference. Sometimes you have huge conferences you can find 500 people. Mm-hmm. Other times, a conference that is manageable and that gives the opportunity to engage into a significant dialogue can have, 60 participants, for example, if you're having 3 days.
Yeah, it is. It may sound very academic, but actually the FEM meeting is not in a academic institution. Cultivamos Cultura is an independent institution, very much like the sanctuary. You don't have to be a scholar to feel that you want to participate or that what you're doing is research, because research is not doesn't only happen in academic environments, and we're very much aware of this. We want to create a space and an event where people from many different fields come together to discuss interesting things that we all are interested in. So you can be a scholar, you can be just an independent artist, a student, a philosopher.
A DIY,
a hacker, mm-hmm. Whatever you are, you're very welcome to join us, and we're very interested.
So maybe a little bit, how would somebody find out about this? I mean, you said it's going to be announced. Where would people see the announcements?
So Facebook and our web pages. So if you go to Cultivamos Cultura or Ectopia, or if you Google TTT Corfu, you're directed straight into Dalila's website, not yours personally.
And hopefully we will send you an email and you will also
be able to help us spread the word.
Uh-huh. Maybe so. Yeah. Do you have examples of the kinds of projects people who've worked on while they're in these? Oh, that's a conference, but you also have residencies too, right?
I do. So Cultivamos Cultura and Ectopia are basically places for residencies, and they are sister institutions. So Ectopia is in a city, in a city you have the advantage of having research institutes there. And basically, Ectopia is directed for artists and practitioners who want to work with scientists. We facilitate the interaction. We help with developing the residencies and the projects in as much as we can. And we have a space where you can reside while working in the lab. Cultivamos Cultura is in a farmhouse. It's in a natural park, so it's a protected area, and the spectrum is a little bit broader. So it doesn't have to be art and biology or anything like that. It is experimental art, and you can experiment in whatever medium you feel comfortable, or you can experiment on anything that you want to explore a little bit more. So we have an intense program. We have about 16 residencies per year or more, and we have exhibitions, and we have summer schools as well. So if you log into our Facebook page, you can see everything that we do.
That's fantastic. Really nice. So what's learned and what's gained by this interaction between science and art and through your conferences?
Well, what is it gain? It completes your, in a way, it completes one's perspective on what is happening around you. You meet very interesting people, too, through these conferences. Maybe you will find a way of solving some issues and putting some more interesting questions.
You find a community. You yes. find people that are doing things that are interesting to you all mm-hmm. over the world. So you create a community. So you may be in your home and there's only a number of people that you know in your neighborhood that will understand what you're talking about when you talk about your research interests. When you come to a conference like this, your community will be wider. There will be people that have similar experiences to you, and there will be people who will give you different paths to pursue, different methodologies to experiment with, will have different perspectives to show you on the things that you're interested in. And all of this is enriching. It's mm-hmm. stimulating. It is exciting to learn, to deal with contemporary culture, which is already so complicated.
Plus, it doesn't stop there.
No.
It will continue even over the internet. You know, we have the absolute need to be in contact with our people all over the world and to help and be helped. So one conference or two conferences a year is just a place where one hangs out.
That's terrific. Thank you so much. That was Marta de Menezes. Say it again.
Marta de Menezes.
Menezes. And Dalila
Honorato.
Would you please say your name? Because I would really like, these are people with Portuguese names, not Spanish names, and they should be pronounced well. Would you please tell me your names?
Marta de Menezes.
Dalila Honorato.
Isn't that beautiful? I'm so pleased. They're visiting the Troy area from Portugal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Our next segment.
The next segment is physician David Borton, who's back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. This week, he and the WOOC correspondent, Megan Marone, speak about parabolas, light traveling from the sun to the earth, and climate change.
We are back with David Borton and our physics segment, Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. Welcome back to the studio, David.
Thank you. It's always good to see you.
Good to see you. So what's on the menu for today?
Well, you said you wanted to talk about parabolas, and I'm not sure why. So why don't you tell me why you want to talk about parabolas?
To be really honest with you, one of my favorite magazines is called Parabola. The subtitle is The Search for Meaning, and it's about interwoven religious and spiritual traditions. But they use the parabola as a metaphor for the arc of questioning meaning, the arc of a human life. So it just always seemed like a really beautiful metaphor to me.
All right, so let's talk about an arc. The first time we talked, what was the arc that we talked about?
The arc of a basketball shooting through the air into a hoop.
Yeah, and that arc gave us what basic laws that are true throughout the universe?
Newton's Big Three.
Newton's Big Three. Good. So the parabola actually is the curve that the basketball follows. So we're good there, right? We're back to where we started. Okay, so now then, my question next is the Earth round or flat? Now, again, you know I'm talking about with respect to solar energy.
Carl Sagan famously had an episode of Cosmos where he talked about the Flatlanders and dimensions. So I feel like this is a trick question. In the year 2018, it's supposed to be pretty easy to answer the question, is the Earth round or flat? It's round. But I have a feeling, you're talking about in regards to solar energy, right?
Correct.
I have a feeling that there's an unexpected twist, and that in regards to the sun permeating the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth is actually flat.
Okay, that's a good answer, because think about the table in front of us, and suppose there was a piece of glass on top of this table.
Okay.
Would you call the table flat?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, and would you call a piece of glass on top of it flat?
Yes.
Okay, so that the Earth's atmosphere is like the piece of glass on top of the table. And the sun, if it's coming from straight overhead, goes straight through the glass. And the sun, if it's coming from 30 degrees above the horizon, goes pretty much straight through the glass also.
Okay,
so with respect to the sun, that going through the Earth's atmosphere at 30 degrees is twice the path as if the sun is coming straight down.
Oh.
And that can be measured. And so that with respect to the sun coming through the Earth's atmosphere, it is as if the Earth was flat.
Oh. How does that relate to climate change?
Okay. If you're inside a building that's got glass and the sun is shining, what happens inside the building?
There's a certain refraction of light off of the glass, right?
Yeah, but what happens inside the building? How do you feel?
Well, if it's a glass building, the sun's streaming in very warm.
Yes. The sun's energy comes in at a short wavelength called light. And you know radio waves and all that. Heat from the sun coming in becomes a longer wavelength, i.e. infrared, and the infrared does not go out through the glass. So that's called the what effect?
Greenhouse.
Ah, yes.
And it's interesting how that term was used before the term climate change became very popular.
Okay, well, if you were on the moon, how would you feel?
What do you mean? If I were in a glass house on the moon?
Well, the moon is very cold. It's the same distance from the sun as the Earth, okay? But it's very cold because there's no atmosphere, so there's no greenhouse effect. So that the climate, if you will, on the moon is not hospitable. In terms of greenhouse effect, the thin layer of atmosphere over the flat Earth, and again, flat in this case refers to the angle of the sun, you know, it heats up the Earth, and the air keeps the heat in so that the climate actually gets warmer.
Well, two things. So first of all, Carl Sagan always described the atmosphere as being so thin that it would be the equivalent of a layer of shellac on a schoolroom globe.
So I called it a layer of glass on the table. Okay, so we're just talking slightly different scales.
Should we be thinking about two spherical objects creating a direct line between them when we think about the sun directly hitting the Earth's atmosphere? That the reason why you could quote-unquote say the Earth is flat is because you've got two spherical objects in relation to one another, and that creates a direct line and a direct line of energy.
Yeah, okay. Well, the direct line of energy then comes down to what we call this table and the glass on it. So the table and the glass is flat with respect to where we are.
Discourse a few years ago was all about holes in the ozone layer and that we had to protect the ozone layer. But you don't really hear that as much in the urgency of the rhetoric about climate change now. There's a general understanding that the atmosphere is trapping more CO2 and more heat. But do people still talk about the ozone layer?
The ozone layer is actually coming back because of the Montreal Protocol, which limited chlorofluorocarbons. And that means that the chlorofluorocarbons are no longer going up into the atmosphere where they can react with the ozone and remove it from the atmosphere. Now, if there was no ozone up there, you and I would fry every time we went out in the sun because the ultraviolet would come through and we would get skin cancers and not be happy.
Would your solar boat go 200 miles an hour as we were destructing?
No, there's not that much energy in the ultraviolet. There's enough to cook us, but not enough to make a big difference to the solar panels.
Hmm. So getting back to parabolas, and actually the issue of climate change often has my friends and I talking about the search for meaning quite a bit. So I'm trying to connect the idea of a magazine called Parabola and how it's about a quest for meaning and what we were just talking about, climate change, and just what a parabola actually is and why we should know about it.
Well, let's talk about the parabola and call it the arc of life and compare that to the arc of a basketball. So how far does the basketball travel from the three-point line to the basket? Okay, so 30 feet, and you know approximately how fast the basketball is going. Sure, I can't remember. But it's about 15 miles an hour.
Okay.
So that 15 miles an hour is going along a horizontal direction, right? Because the basketball first goes up, mm-hmm. and because it's in gravity, there is a what on it? The gravitational
pull.
Gravitation, and Newton's second law says that if there's an unbalanced force on an object, the object will accelerate.
Right.
Okay, so if the object is going up, the force is in the other direction. And so the basketball goes up for a while, and then it stops, and then it starts to come down, accelerating again with the speed of gravity.
How's that like a parabola?
That is a parabola.
The entire trajectory of the basketball is a parabola.
Yes.
That was the local artist, educator, and solar boat builder, David Borton, and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone with Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. They were speaking about parabolas and climate change. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk magazine to catch Dr. Borton and his popular science segments every week.
For those just tuning in, I'm Ray.
And I'm Annie. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy.
To learn more about Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Our next guest is Kevin Hickey. He's a longtime Sanctuary supporter, and his daughter, Sina, was a Sanctuary intern. Kevin is Associate Professor of Africana Studies, English, and Humanities at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He's a producer of the 14th Annual Africana Film Series. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Ray.
Tell us something about the Africana Film Series.
Well, the first three Tuesdays of every February, I show three different films. And as you've already mentioned, this is the 14th year. And every year there's a theme. So last year it was Senegal. This year it is North Africa. And next year it will be Africans in Europe. So it begins at 7 o'clock on the first three Tuesdays. So this year, that's the 6th, the 13th, and the 20th of February. And it includes some pizza and some drinks. And I usually have 20 to 30 students and 30 to 40 people from off campus. So it's an interesting mix because a lot of the people who come from off campus are either from Africa originally or have worked in Africa, or in some cases just have an interest in Africa, or I suppose in a few cases just come for the free pizza. And so it is, I think, worth attending, of course, to see the films. And but I think in many ways, at least for me, the somewhat the most exciting part are the conversations that we have after the films, and when we talk about the films in the context of Africa, and and have often a robust conversation amongst people with all sorts of different experiences in Africa. It is free, including the food is free, and I also have an email. I email out details, so if anybody would like to get onto that email list that gives details on the films and the times and the location, they should just put in my last name, Hickey, just go to Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, or probably just put ACPHS Africana, and it'll come up.
You know, you said that the two places the films are from this year are where? Senegal?
Last year the theme was Senegal.
Okay.
Next year it's Africans in Europe, and this year it's North Africa. So we have two Moroccan films and one film from Chad.
So one of the things I find very confusing is so many people I know, and myself as well, really don't notice that Africa is made up of such an enormous amount of spaces. So when you say North Africa, is that basically along the Mediterranean Sea, or does it come – how far down is Chad?
Well, Chad would officially not be North Africa for a variety of reasons. I ended up having that film, which is bordering Libya, which is, of course, North Africa.
Okay.
So but officially, North Africa is basically Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. You could perhaps add Western Sahara to North Africa.
Okay.
This is your 14th year. How did this get started?
Well, when I taught at Western Connecticut State University, there was an anthropologist there who had an Africana film series, and so I helped him out with that. And then when I got the local job here, then I started my own series.
And how is the series funded?
Well, for about the first 10 years, my college's library purchased the films. And, you don't need a lot of money, but you need some money because you don't just buy the DVD. You have to buy it with public viewing rights. And so that adds a few hundred dollars to each film. And about maybe 4 years ago, my own department and sort of school within the college, the School of Arts and Sciences within the larger college framework, they've taken over the funding.
I see. The African population of the capital region, are they supportive of this particular film?
Well, I have some maybe 20, 25 people who were born in Africa who come to the film, which means probably about eight or so show up, eight or 10 maybe show up for each film. So, yes, it is certainly supported.
I understand you travel across Africa by bicycle some time ago. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was a while ago. Actually, the first showing of each year, I also show my image movie about my four-year bicycle trip across Africa. And it's now gotten to the point where I have to say, well, that guy you're going to see, that's actually me, because now I, I used to have blonde red hair and a big red beard, and those are gone. So, but it was a four-year trip, so basically half a year in North Africa. Then I crossed the Sahara, which took 3 months, and then a year in West Africa, a year in Central Africa, a year in East Africa, and half a year in Southern Africa. So that adds up to 4 years. And I should add, the last 2 years of that trip were with my future wife, who is now just retired from teaching German and French at Gilteland High School.
So what years were these?
That was 80 to 84. The whole trip was a six-year trip. First, I did 2 years in Africa. So the whole trip was 78 to 84, 2 years in Europe and 4 years in Africa.
Very interesting and impressive, I think.
Thanks.
I just have to ask you, can you bicycle across the Sahara? I'm used to thinking of it as sand.
Yes. Well, you can bicycle to Tamanrasset, and then you can bicycle beginning in Arlit, where the uranium mine is, which was part of George Bush's bogus reason for invading Iraq. But from Tamanrasset to Arlit, it's about the distance from Albany to Buffalo, and there's no road there. So that was largely pulling the bike through the sand.
Yeah. Mm. Wow. Have you been back to Africa?
I take students to Senegal, which, of course, is the West African country closest to North America. It's actually, Senegal is closer to North America than Europe. So, yes, I just took students to Senegal this past summer.
Yeah, I live in the downtown of Troy, and so I have met quite a number, but that's really not true. I've met maybe seven. Mm-hmm. People from Togo and Ghana. Mm-hmm. Now I think about it, I've met about 12. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because they stand out. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because I've talked to them and I'm used to thinking that people speak English. And I've got these wonderful French accents and other accents mm-hmm. over their English. Mm-hmm. But it's been a real delight to me to see that we have included people from countries I didn't expect into this country.
Yes. Well, let me pick up on that with the language, because, of course, we just had a woman from Greece and a woman from Portugal speaking English flawlessly. And Africans in particular, of course, everything's a bell curve, so you certainly have plenty of Africans who only speak one language. But overall, Africans tend to be quadrilingual, and I'll just use that little point about the linguistic abilities of Africans in general to make a comment about our recent president's point about immigrants from Africa, and how it'd be much nicer if we had immigrants from Norway. And of course, number one, I don't think there's many people in Norway who actually want to move to the U.S. But on top of that, just a quick little statistic, which is, according to the recent U.S. Census, 31% of Americans have a BS degree or higher, and 41% of people born in Africa living in the U.S. have have a BS degree. So that's a significant difference on the side of the average African immigrant. So I guess if we're going to use statistics like that, we should say, well, let's open the doors, because it'll just increase the number of deciding or evaluating somebody as educated. Obviously, you can be very educated without a university degree, and you can have a university degree and not necessarily be that educated. But nevertheless, it's a marker that perhaps is useful in that conversation.
Just to mention that, one of the people that I know is Teddy from Ghana, mm-hmm. and he is one of those people who got the lottery ticket that mm-hmm. got him here to the United States. He said he was a very happy wrestler in a town right by the ocean, and he adores mm-hmm. where he was living. But mm-hmm. he signed up for the lottery, and he won, so he had no choice but to come. He's worked really, really hard. I've known him now for about 10 years.
Oh, I love Ghana. Great food in Ghana, and wonderful people.
Yeah.
Kevin, you mentioned the student trips to Senegal. Mm-hmm. What is the function of those trips? What's the educational objective there?
Well, I teach a course called Culture and Customs of Senegal, and then the students take an incomplete in the course, and we go then to Senegal for 3 weeks, and the students shadow a particular job. So most of my students shadow people working in health and healthcare, physicians, health clinics, et cetera. But you can also shadow in women's rights, education, urban planning. And so they shadow people in these fields. And we pay for students who are getting their master's degrees in English in Senegal to act as translators. And, of course, they act not only to translate from Wolof or French into English, but, of course, they're Senegalese, so they also provide a lot of cultural knowledge. And then after those week to 10 days, depending on how things work out, then we spend another 10 days traveling around Senegal. And I do this with a wonderful, wonderful colleague who's a French professor at Union, Cheikh Njie, who's a professor in the French department who's from Senegal. So it's the two of us who are leading that. And it used to include a third person, Eloise Briere from the French department at UAlbany, but she's retired. So at the moment, it's just the two of us. But so it's actually two college Union students and my ACPHS students combining.
Just to interrupt and question. I'm retired now. I can travel. Should I go to Africa? Is that a good place to visit?
Certainly. Yes. Well, I mean, you can make it difficult or you can make it easy. It all depends on where you go and what you want to do. But I would definitely recommend going to Africa. And I'm a particular fan of West Africa myself. I mean, I really like Central Africa, but things are a little bit more difficult in Central Africa. But West Africa is wonderful. But really, everywhere in Africa is worth visiting, of course.
Terrific. Thank you, Kevin.
My pleasure.
That was Kevin Hickey, whose Africana Film Festival screens at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays during the month of February, the 6th, the 13th, and the 20th. For more information, Google Africana Film Series, Albany.
Next, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine brings, for the first, for our final segment, we are joined by David King, editor and associate publisher of the Alt Magazine, the music editor, Katie Kuzak, and news editor, Luke Stoddard-Nathan. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
You need to be, when you talk, you need to be about this close.
Okay.
So tell us about the Alt.
We started around last November. We're an alternative news weekly that is in some ways filling the void created when Metroland went under a few years ago, the old alternative news weekly. We focus on covering the arts and entertainment and doing a lot of in-depth reporting and investigative reporting.
So what's new in this week's issue?
A lot of things. We've been focused a lot on Albany lately, and as you know, that it's sort of known for corruption and scandal, and there's a lot of that going on, which isn't exactly surprising. But to start with, we noticed this week that the state senate, which has faced a lot of sexual harassment issues in the past, just added a new portion to their sexual harassment policy that really harps on the idea that you're going to get in trouble if you make up an accusation that's false. And this was striking to us given that there is now this large sexual harassment claim against one of the heads of the legislature. So it was very striking because I've spent a lot of time in the legislature in my career, and all of us here have covered the legislature, and we know that there's a real problem with sexual harassment. And to see them sort of move in this blatant way during a time when these issues are being harassed, I think was striking to us. And I think it's something that should be pointed out to voters that in this time when so many people are fighting for their rights and fighting to be heard, that suddenly the state senate is doing more to sort of scare folks off. And I think Katie can talk to some of her experiences with
just Katie, go ahead.
Talking to some of the reporters and
I want to say, Katie, I saw the magazine this week, and I saw that it's quite an extensive article. Thank you.
Oh, for the sanctuary piece?
No, for the sexual.
That was actually by another by a freelancer.
Yeah.
But yes,
okay.
Katie and I have visited Albany to find ourselves confronted by actual sexual harassment in progress. So,
right.
And Katie's actually spoken to a number of people off the record about what it's like to work in the Capitol, and I think she's found some.
Yeah, I think, off the saying that, you know, they choose to speak off the record is an important point to make, is that people still aren't comfortable talking about their experiences yet and opening up about what's really happened to them when they're trying to do their jobs just like everybody else. So it's something that's we still have to face, even though it seems like we're making a lot of progress in this area. And obviously it's something that's close to home, even though it seems like this really big national, hopefully global movement that continues. So, yeah, hopefully we can continue to shed some light on that, especially at a local level in Albany and in our local government.
One of the other things that we're focused on, the governor who is up for re-election, Governor Andrew Cuomo, he's up for re-election this fall, and I think everyone knows he has his eyes set on the presidency. Right now, one of the biggest corruption trials I think in the history of the state is going on, and it involves his closest friend, someone that he said his father thought of as a third son, someone who the governor kept by his side throughout all his political life and a lot of his private life as well. So Luke has actually been covering the trial and has done a lot of dirt. He revealed he had some big scoops early on last year about how the feds had information that this man, Joseph Prococo, was the governor's best friend, routinely called high-level members of the state government and threatened them. And, you know, told them they could lose their jobs or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He was known to be a bit of a bully. So today we got a lot of new information on that in the trial. And just some commentary of my own, I think it reflects very poorly on the governor. But Luke could probably talk to more.
Well, so just to back up for a second, the gist against the former aide's name, Joseph Prococo, is that he took bribes. That's the allegation. That he took bribes from two real estate executives and also from an energy company executive. And the bribes totaled upwards of about $300,000. And that in exchange for receiving these bribes, Joseph Prococo took certain actions that benefited the companies that these lobbyists or these executives represented. And, you know, there was a lot of speculation as this case was going to trial. And we're in our second week now of the trial this week. They're sort of wondering what's going to come out of this trial, what sort of new allegations or new details are going to emerge from this trial. And one of the most interesting things that I just sort of picked out, or that has come up this week or maybe last week, was that when Joseph Prococo left state service to help run the governor's reelection campaign, it actually has materialized that he kind of stayed in office, or he kept using his state office even though he was out of state government, and that he was using government resources while he was kind of technically out of state service. So that's sort of something interesting to watch, kind of as the trial kind of progresses.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who left the governor's office technically and took another job later, actually, and was working for Madison Square Garden. And still, while working for Madison Square Garden, he was showing up at the governor's side during rallies. He was bullying press. He was calling donors to look for donations. And, you know, the point is you can't be working a campaign and be in, you know, also serve an incumbent. But it also seemed like it went to another level where he was working with people who had business in front of the state and also working as an enforcer for the governor. But there's still tension about whether we see the governor himself being called to testify. I think it's doubtful, but he's on the witness list. So,
well, one of the things I really appreciate is that you really have good news. I mean, really well-developed news. I'm a lifelong member of living in downtown Troy, so I really like seeing that it's fully developed journalism when you talk about Troy.
Yeah, I mean, we've been following, one of the stories we've been following is the eminent domain procedure as it unfolds by the Uncle Sam parking garage. I don't know if you guys have followed that.
The Capital
at all,
District Transportation Authority bus.
Yes, you know, they've been trying to get a bus station built or a new sort of high speed transit hub built kind of around where the David Bryce's parking garage is down in downtown Troy, and they've been negotiating for a number of years, and we recently reported that the CDTA has begun to do proceed in an eminent domain procedure to obtain space to be able to build that bus stop. And David Bryce, the real estate developer, has brought a lawsuit to kind of challenge that taking. So that's kind of unfolding as it happens.
What I mentioned. David Bryce bought the Troy Atrium parking garage. It was had major maintenance issues, and the city realized that they really couldn't afford to fix it, and so they sold it to David Bryce, and he rehabilitated it and added an extra floor on it.
Yeah,
that's why he owns it at the moment.
It's a really interesting kind of debate, you know, because I think that both parties agree, both CDTA and David Bryce, both seem to want to move the project forward, but it seems to be kind of floundering for a number of years. So something to watch.
What are the challenges of running the ALT in the current media environment?
The challenges are that we have limited funds and that we have to break through the Facebook algorithm and all of that. But there are some unique opportunities, I think, that we have because of our design. I think we've read a lot about the flaws in Alt Weeklies and how the cell phone has replaced the Alt Weekly and those sort of stories with the voice no longer printing and things like that. But it's been interesting to discover that because of the rest of the media sort of downsizing, because the Times Union has fewer staffers, because there are fewer print journalists, and I forgive me, but I do think print journalists do better work than television journalists. But because of that, we have a lot of space to work in, and there are stories available to us that might have been harder to get if in another period of time. And then on top of that, being an Alt Weekly, we cover entertainment, we cover arts, we want to bring folks together on that. We want to legitimize arts, but at the same time, that gives us a little room to let Luke work on large investigative stories and put in months at a time on issues, and it gives us time to dive deep into things that we really think are important. It's a luxury that a lot of journalists don't have anymore. So that's the refreshing part of what we do.
So did you start after the Metroland stopped printing?
We did. We started not last year, but the year before. And I actually got my journalism start at Metroland as an intern. I was there early 2000s and sort of watched it and all the issues it had. And went on and thought, wow, it would be really nice to make this work somehow. And somehow I got that chance. It's a little miraculous, but
In terms of distribution, where does I walk around town and I see the ALT, but I mean, it's kind of like here and there. Where would I, in general, if I was out looking for one, look?
Well, we distribute to 25,000. We distribute 25,000 copies. I'm not sure the current number of locations, but you can visit thealt.com and we have a distribution site. But we mainly focus on, you can find us in the suburbs, but if you're really looking for us, the best bet is downtown cafes, bars, music venues, and places like that.
The city of Troy lobby. Yeah,
has it. We've actually found city halls like us. It's odd. We haven't been picked out of one yet. We're waiting.
So the word the ALT, does that stand for something?
It's just short for the Alt Weekly. I wasn't involved in naming the paper, but this is all developed and branded before the ALT became a shorthand for the alt-right. Mm-hmm. I think for the folks who put it together, it was shorthand for Alt Weekly. I think it was sort of supposed to be ubiquitous and like, we're the Alt Weekly. There's no other.
The alternative.
And you do have to remember the alternative left and alt media was more of a thing long before the alt right ever existed. We did get some press back from folks who were concerned about that. And funny enough, we got a lot of praise from the alt right until they read our articles, which was a hoot. It presented some challenges, and we had some articles written about us. And in the end, I think what the publishers have said to us is that we'll be around a lot longer than the word the alt, the alt right, that is. So I hope so.
Hopefully. You were discussing the corruption trial. What other news items do you see looming on the horizon?
Well, Luke actually had a pretty big scoop that the Times Union just reported today, and they referenced our work. But Luke, do you want to sort of talk about
Yeah, very, very briefly, there's a new Amtrak train station being built in Schenectady, and it's rather complicated, but the gist is that the construction is beginning just now. The contractor that is building that train station was recently thrown off another project really at the Harriman campus about a few months before it was awarded this contract by the Department of Transportation to build this train station. And so I kind of luckily kind of stumbled upon this item, and we reported it, and then the Daily Gazette picked it up, and then the Times Union just mentioned it just before we got on the air. So.
And Luke is sort of modest about this in some ways, or at least he won't sensationalize it. And it deserves a little sensationalizing, because these folks actually, you know, the job was so badly botched that the water was actually tainted with lead on this, you know, in the Harriman project, campus. And people were so concerned that there was a hearing about, you know, well, should we really give these guys this contract? Look how badly they botched this. And the hearings are ongoing right now. So I think it should be a concern to folks that a project this big for not only Schenectady but the Capital Region's transportation corridor is in the hands of a group that that has proved, you know, proved that it couldn't be held responsible for doing this project. And they do have a lot of excuses and sort of, they put forward a lot of reasons that they weren't successful in this project. But at the same time, the idea that there were only two people that bid, I believe, was.
Yep.
And they won. It's a little weird because it's a big, prestigious contract.
Having been in the area for a long time, and also having worked for a while for a politically connected real estate lawyers, it's really clear that we do need to watch all of our government, participate in all of our government. Yeah. So I really appreciate that. But you also do other kinds of things, not just political things.
Yeah, this week we actually tried to have a little fun. We're doing our winter guide, sort of about how to stay sane in the winter in the Capital Region, and maybe that could have been a little more useful during the sub-zero temperatures. But Katie had two really interesting pieces, one about foraging and one about some of the best comfort dishes to make it through the winter. So, Katie, if you want to...
Yeah, I had the opportunity to talk to David Muska. He's a local like nature guide in the area, and he does a lot of foraging classes and foraging apprenticeships. So he sort of talked me through some of the main things that you can find when you're out digging around. He did reiterate that you should only do so on your private property or somewhere where you can actually, it's like an allotted area for people to go foraging on, because there are some pretty strict regulations.
Your other project too?
And the other project that I did was the comfort foods around the region. I just talked to a lot of chefs about sort of the main dishes that they have to offer. So you should check that out if you want to find some good comfort food menu items in the local area.
I'm so delighted. Are you coming back other Tuesdays, do you think?
Yeah, we're planning on it.
That'd be wonderful. That's David King, editor and associate publisher of the Alt Weekly magazine, and the music editor, Katie Cusack, and news editor, Luke Stoddard-Nathan. You can find The Alt on local newsstands and on the tables in local cafes and public buildings throughout the Capital Region and online at thealt.com. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Annie.
And I'm Ray. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.